Thanks for downloading this podcast from The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, and if you're ready, we'll begin. And yes, it's Groundhog Day. Who remembers how that movie began?
That's right, Woodchuck Chuckers, it's Groundhog Day!
That's right, happens every year. A little town near Pennsylvania, Washington, D.C.
Mr. President, with all due respect, your budget spends too much, taxes too much, and borrows too much.
I am committed to restoring a sense of honesty and accountability to our budget.
Ned Ryerson!
It happens year 2009.
The budget before the House, I think, makes the economy worse.
Gone through every department spending, line by line.
After year 2010.
A budget that will continue to destroy jobs.
To eliminate waste and inefficiency.
After year 2011.
Taxes too much and it borrows too much.
If we're serious about getting something done.
Ned Ryerson, I did the whistling belly button trick at the high school talent show. Bing!
Will they ever get the budget right?
1,000 people freezing their butts off waiting to worship a rat.
You mean a groundhog named Phil. Is that what we would call the 2015 federal budget? Will Obama find love at the end of it all? Will grumpy John Boehner find redemption like Bill Murray did?
Bing!
Then put your
I've got you. As far as D.C. is concerned, we've got them on this Groundhog Day, the annual ritual of the federal budget process, which, as far as I can tell, has never had an impact on the length of the winter, never predicted the beginning of spring, but it has sounded the same year of the Obama era. The very, very identical scene played out yet again. The president wants to increase spending by about 7%, lose the sequestration limits passed in a moment of weakness that never seemed to work anyway. He seeks revenue from offshore corporate profits to fund spikes in spending of about $530 billion in non-defense areas and about $560 billion on the defense side. That's what we're expecting when the budget is rolled out officially today. Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent, is with us. Todd, welcome.
Hi, John.
And it's Groundhog's Day. You know that?
Yeah. Boy, do I. I've covered all these budgets, and you're right. They do have an element of repetition, and there's also the element of, you know, the president's budget being dead on arrival in a Republican-controlled House, and this year a Republican-controlled Senate. You know, take that groundhog, kind of shove it back down in the hole without looking at its face, I suppose. There's an element to that, too.
Is there a radical change in the way the White House is approaching this budget? Is there some confidence, maybe more sense of let's go for broke here?
Well, there is more confidence, and there's a couple of reasons why. And John, really, in your artful introduction there, there's a lot of truth behind it. But there's also some things in this budget process that are really real, despite the repetitious kind of dysfunctional appearance of it all. There is some new confidence from the White House, and for two main reasons. One, the economy is starting to hum, and deficits are down. They're way down, according to the CBO. And that gives policymakers more freedom in what they feel they can do with spending, for sure, especially looking out into the long term. On the other hand, also, how about carrots? The president knows that there's a new Republican Congress, and there's things that they want. They spot a moment, too. They want to do tax reform, a big $1 trillion worth of reforming corporate taxes. That means there's something they really, really want. And if the president plays his cards right, he can get some stuff out of them so that they can get their tax reform. You mentioned sequestration, and that's really important. John, it actually has really worked. It's worked because it's under the skin of just about every lawmaker in Washington for different reasons. But sequestration, those spending caps that the president and John Boehner and Mitch McConnell and Capitol Hill put on themselves when they couldn't agree to a budget a couple of years ago, it's basically had the desired effect. It's gotten really under the skin of Republicans who don't like the caps on defense spending and homeland security, Democrats who don't like the caps on domestic discretionary spending like Head Start and Ebola funding and NIH and the CDC and things like that. The president is trying to show some light, a little crack in the door for a way out. And that's part of what this budget does. You got to read between the lines to see it. But, you know, the president is saying really to Republicans, if you can come along with me on some priorities, hey, look what's buried in here. 8% increase in defense spending? That's pretty good. Republicans want that. They're going to have to play ball to get it.
Well, the irony here is that sequestration was supposed to not impose those mandatory caps. They were supposed to actually make a deal to avoid those caps. Those caps were like punishment, but they couldn't do it. And so now they're stuck with the sequestration caps, and they're going to have to eliminate them, move away from them. Oddly, sequestration is like a motivation for these two parties to come together.
Right. Well, it's true that it failed in its initial function, which was to force people to get a deal because sequestration was supposed to be so lousy they would get a deal. It proved that the political situation was even lousier than the pain of proposed sequestration. So you ended up with it. Now everybody hates it. And that second part, the fact that everybody hates it, was also part of the plan. It's supposed to drive people to make deals in the future. And the president is acknowledging the fact that a lot of people on his side hate the cuts in, you know, things like NIH and CDC. There's big increases for Ebola funding for the National Institutes of Health, big increases in this budget for cybersecurity, for homeland security, and that big defense increase too. And so a way out of sequestration, both implicitly and explicitly, is part of what the president is offering here.
So two things, Todd. Number one, what do Republicans think about this offshore corporate profits tax idea that the president seems to have floated here? And what do Republicans say when you ask them about how much economic growth we already have? Consistently, the argument has been the president is constraining growth. I'm wondering if that argument even works anymore.
To the second question first, Republicans do acknowledge growth, but they acknowledge it grudgingly, and they say it would be even faster were it not for government spending, but also the big one, Obamacare. That's the main Republican response to this. Now, you asked about a repatriation of corporate profits. There are hundreds of billions of dollars of American profits held overseas. The president wants to raise taxes on those, take away the protection that those profits have from taxes, spend some of the money on infrastructure. That's one of his proposals. But when it comes down to it, you're seeing a Republican response, John, that really is against spending more and taxing either the wealthy or corporations more. Listen to Paul Ryan here quickly on NBC's Meet the Press.
What I think the president is trying to do here is to, again, exploit envy economics. This top-down redistribution doesn't work. We've been doing it for 6 years. Look, it may make for good politics. It doesn't make for good economic growth.
Envy economics?
That's Paul Ryan's new brand for, what did they used to call it, a class warfare. I guess class warfare is sort of maybe played out as a buzzword. Envy economics is the new one. The president has proposed, and we all saw it before the State of the Union, raising capital gains taxes on the very wealthiest investors, this corporate repatriation of profits. That's going to be part of the fight on tax reform. Republicans don't like higher taxes, John. But again, they want corporate tax reform, and they're going to have to make a deal to get it.
Todd Zwillig, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Thanks, Todd.
You got it, John.
From fiscal squabbles at home to a prisoner release in Egypt, Al Jazeera's Peter Grest was released over the weekend after serving more than a year of a 7-year sentence for conspiring with enemies of the Egyptian government. Grest has been deported to his native Australia, but this is far from the end of the story. It appears the Egyptian government has won in its battle with the global media to keep journalists from reporting on the political opposition in a country essentially back to military rule. Joining me now is Sue Turton, senior correspondent for Al Jazeera English, who was convicted in absentia in the same case. She's speaking from London. Welcome, Sue.
Thank you. Good to talk to you.
So what has the reaction been at Al Jazeera? Obviously one of relief, but there's more work to do.
Yes, exactly that. Great relief. We were hearing for hours and hours before Peter actually called to say he was at the airport departure lounge about to leave Cairo, that he was going to be released. But I don't think we kind of believed it until we heard his voice. But now, as you say, that the fight really is on to get Mohamed Fahmy, who's half Canadian. And it does sound like in the coming hours, his deportation to Canada is imminent. But then once that happens, we've really got another fight on our hands. And this is going to be the toughest of all because Baha Mohamed, our producer, is Egyptian. He has no other place that he can be deported to. All he can do is hope that the Egyptian judicial system, when we have a retrial, will be fair and honest and transparent and will recognize that there is no real charge to answer and he is an innocent man.
What has this done to Al Jazeera's ability to operate in Egypt?
Yeah, they've pretty much frozen our movements around Egypt. We can't send in reporters now. All we can do is try and report remotely, which wouldn't be the only channel to be doing that. I think a lot of channels have taken heed to what's happened to us and recognise that you can't really do any proper independent reporting on the streets of Egypt anymore. The press crackdown has not improved since 2013. And indeed, I don't know if you saw, but just a couple of weeks ago, the BBC's Orla Gurin, a really well-respected reporter, was out on the streets covering the Muslim Brotherhood protesters being rounded up by the police. And a plainclothes officer turned to her and said, "If you carry on filming, we will shoot you." Now, that kind of sums up in a nutshell what it's like still trying to report in Egypt for everybody.
And the message is that the Muslim Brotherhood are an illegal terrorist organization, according to the Egyptian government, and therefore journalists even trying to contact the group that was once the elected majority political group in Egypt will be subject to death or imprisonment.
No, exactly that. And if you cast your mind back to 2011 and that euphoria on the streets of Egypt after the revolution, when they were given the chance to vote for their own president, and they voted in Mohamed Morsi, the Muslim Brotherhood representative. He was the guy that they chose. Now, it all obviously went downhill after that. And there was a coup in 2013. Now you talk to Egyptian watchers and they will say the actual human rights situation, anybody trying to speak out in any way against the government, that we're looking at a situation that's worse than it was under President Mubarak, the president that the revolution took place to depose. So it's almost like they've turned the clock right back in Egypt.
Who has leverage here and who might have exerted that leverage to get Peter Grest out?
They're very close to the Saudi Arabians, to the United Arab Emirates. I mean, those particular countries in the Middle East, very much backing the current Egyptian government and president. There was a big falling out with Qatar and those countries early last year. And in that one respect, really did not help matters and help the situation for our guys, who in the end were being used as pawns in a huge geopolitical row. But I think that the people have made friends again. The GCC countries all sitting around the table again, and Qatar's been welcomed back into the fold. And relations between Qatar and Egypt have really improved over the last 6 months. So I think there has been quite a lot of diplomatic maneuverings with all of those countries. And I think a lot of that has played into the situation we have now seen, that at least one of our guys is free.
Sue Turton, senior correspondent for Al Jazeera English. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. And the football season ended last night in our house and everywhere else in America. We're not big football fans in my house, but I am a casual Seahawks fan from living there for years in the 1980s. But this year, my little five-year-old boy Ajax followed the Seahawks all season long, keeping track of the teams and scores and standings, following them all the way to last night's game against the New England Patriots. He insisted that I make fried chicken and have a party for what he was sure would be a victory. And we did. Little Ajax made posters and gave everyone a picture to hold up and root the Seahawks on. And Super Bowl 49 was one to remember there on the grass flown in from Alabama to University of Arizona Stadium, all the balls inflated and locked away, way more than 100 million viewers along with Ajax and his family and the Takeaway family watching intently, a game that was up in the air right up until the end.
In those last few minutes, you know, my heart was pounding, but in the end, the Pats ended up pulling it off. We did a great job. I still think the better team won, but it was a great match. I could not have asked for a better game.
Man, getting that close to the very end, woo, it had my heart pounding. And they did. It was phenomenal. It was a phenomenal game. And, you know, the two best teams played it, and that was the point.
Ross and Devin there from New England. I can hear the smiles on your faces. Just like I turned to smiling Ajax with 20 seconds to go, as I said to him, 2 yards, second down and goal to go. Give the ball to Marshawn Lynch, the never-fail running back. didn't happen.
They'd sent in goal line. It's not the right matchup for us to run the football. So we, on second down, we throw the ball really to kind of waste that play. If we score, we do. If we don't, then we'll run it in on third and fourth down. Really with no second thoughts and no hesitation in that at all.
Pete Carroll, the Seahawks head coach, sounded pretty dejected there as he explained to the world why he ran a pass play on second down, a pass play intercepted by Malcolm Butler of the Patriots, and it was over. In my living room, there was some, oh well, good game, exclamations, and then we looked down and little Ajax was crying, tears streaming down his face.
It's really sad. We gave such a great effort, especially in the last couple of minutes. We kind of are a comeback team, so I definitely always give the Seahawks the last 2 minutes to make up for everything, and so it was really disappointing that in the last 2 minutes we couldn't follow through.
Thanks, Courtney Rondell in Seattle. She knows what sadness is. And Patriots fan Caitlin Fishman in Boston had some kind words for all the heartbroken.
I honestly thought that we were going to lose it, and they were very close to getting that touchdown, so they should be very proud of themselves. That was down to the very last end.
My son Ajax had trouble looking on the bright side. He stayed up late, collapsed in a heap, and sobbed himself to sleep. It's not fair. They were right there, he said. Seahawks fan Abe Ravi found a bright side.
I'm making so many friends. I'm talking to people because of the Seahawks. It's what brings us together. This is what brings Seattle together. And I love them. Whether or not for Super Bowl, I love the Seahawks. Go Seahawks.
Seahawks or Patriots fan, we want to hear how you feel about the Super Bowl. I've got my work cut out for me getting Ajax up for the next season. And thanks so much for the work of Phyllis Fletcher, managing editor at KUOW in Seattle, and Craig LaMold at WGBH in Boston for finding all that testimony from fans watching last night's game. Are you satisfied with the results? Why or why not?
This is Carly Gillum from Kirkland, Washington. I flew down for the game with my husband to L.A., and we drove to Phoenix. While it was a heartbreaking loss in the end, it was great to see all of the fellow fans who came down to see.
Now there's a dedicated fan. Thanks, Carly, for calling 877-8-MY-TAKE. You can all just tweet us at The Takeaway. All one word, at The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from LegalZoom. For over 10 years, providing solutions for business owners, families, and individuals to get legal help, including incorporation, LLCs, wills, and living trusts. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com.
Next week, a team from the National Institutes of Health, along with other international medical teams, begin testing a new Ebola vaccine in disease-ravaged Liberia. At the same time, clusters of unvaccinated children in some U.S. communities is being blamed for an increase in measles infections. There was a time when the miracle of vaccines seemed to settle matters with diseases that had plagued humanity for centuries. Smallpox, diphtheria, and polio, once deadly scourges in the face of widespread government-supervised vaccination, were eliminated.
The greatest medical news in history. Dr. Jonas Salk discovers a vaccine that promises to wipe out childhood's crippling and killing enemy, polio.
The polio vaccine developed by Jonas Salk in the 1950s came at a peak moment of trust in government and medical science. But such is not the situation today, and how we got here bears recalling. And so we welcome Retro Report producer Bonnie Bertram to The Takeaway. Welcome back.
Hi, nice to be here.
So how did we get to this point where measles is back and trust in vaccinations is very dubious?
Well, it's important to remember that nationwide vaccination rates are pretty high, but there are these enclaves where it's really dangerously low. And so we looked at sort of the media's role and how we got to this point where personal belief is more powerful than scientific evidence. And we thought the media had some culpability in this because it gave people a platform to tell very powerful personal stories. And when it comes to storytelling, it's hard for scientific evidence to stack up against that because it's so powerful to hear these stories that parents tell.
And here's celebrity Jenny McCarthy on Larry King Live and Oprah telling the story of her son.
We vaccinated our baby and something happened. That's it.
We begin, of course, with Jenny McCarthy, the actress and entertainment personality. Her son, Evan, has autism.
Look it. It's plain and simple. It's bullshit.
No, it's...
Yes, it is.
My science is named Evan, and he's at home. That's my science.
Now, it's well known that the media will do a, on the one hand, on the other hand, approach to stories. In cases of science, this can be pretty difficult. What happened here?
Well, it was funny because it happened around the time when a lot of news organizations were gutting their science departments and a lot of science reporters were let go. And when Jenny McCarthy got involved, a lot of entertainment reporters started covering essentially science. And it wasn't really a story about vaccines. It was a story about what this celebrity and former Playboy model was telling everybody about her son who has autism.
And the specific charge that has been scientifically tested and has never been confirmed is that vaccinations contain chemicals, mercury perhaps, which induce autism in young children.
Well, it's sort of twofold. There was a 1998 study by a British doctor. It's been roundly, completely debunked. He's lost his medical license. And that happened in 1998 that the article appeared, and then he got sort of cast aside later. So that opened up the doors for people to take another look at, are vaccines possibly dangerous and causing autism? And then what happened later than that was that this additive thimerosal, it's a preservative to vaccines, people thought it contained mercury. It contains ethyl mercury, which is not the same as methyl mercury, which you and I know not to eat tuna fish because there's methyl mercury in it.
Yeah.
It's a neurotoxin. So ethyl mercury is probably not as toxic. There is still some science around that, but there have been definitive tests that show of hundreds of thousands of children that there is no link between vaccines and autism.
Add to this a sense of distrust of the government in the time of sort of Edward Snowden, that sort of thing, and you've got a widespread suspicion of vaccinations, and that leads us to measles.
Well, what's funny too, I mean, not funny really, but when a scientist talks and the CDC delivers language that's been approved by scientists, they say, to the best of our knowledge, at this point, there's no evidence. And so to people who aren't steeped in that kind of vernacular, it sounds like, oh my God, what are they hiding from us?
The question is, can President Obama fight that?
Measles is preventable. I understand that there are families that in some cases are concerned about the effect of vaccinations. The science is, you know, pretty indisputable. We've looked at this again and again. There is every reason to get vaccinated. There aren't reasons to not.
Is that a bully pulpit, or is he just part of the conspiracy, depending on who you are?
Well, you know, science is not about conducting experiments until you get the results you think you want to see. And unfortunately, with a lot of these anti-vaccine people who believe their story so powerfully that they can't accept that there really is no link between vaccines and autism.
The media and vaccination rates in the United States. To see a video of Retro Report's findings, visit thetakeaway.org. Bonnie Bertram is a Retro Report producer. Thanks so much.
Thanks. Thanks, John.
I float as the clouds on air, do I enjoy being a girl?
Do women and girls enjoy being themselves online? Online, people can say what they want and generally do. This can be a good thing. This can be a disturbing thing. This week, we begin a series of conversations about the emerging feminine and feminist culture online. Being a woman online entails liberation, as women and girls find communities free of men and devoted to candor in ways not possible in everyday conversation. The internet also intensifies sexuality and poses challenges, as well as enabling men and women to connect. The battle between the sexes is also inflamed online. Feminist YouTube host Anita Sarkeesian has been called a despicable whore for her critiques of sexism. In 2012, Holly Jacobs discovered that her ex-boyfriend posted intimate photos of her, along with her name and contact information, without her consent. She sought legal recourse for this revenge attack and found California Congresswoman Jackie Speier. We begin our series looking at Congresswoman Speier's efforts to make the online world safe from sexual predation and revenge attacks.
The internet is so universal now, and it becomes so much more than just a photograph. It becomes your entire resume. There is one particular victim, her name is Holly Jacobs, who has for 3.5 years tried to get pictures of herself that have been strewn all over the internet off, and she's gone to law enforcement over and over again, and they say there is no law that protects you. And this is an effort, whether it's because a jilted lover is taking pictures and putting them on the internet, or someone has broken into someone else's phone, that no matter how that photograph has been taken, once it's up there and it's been asked to be taken down and is not taken down, then there is a criminal act.
So based on what you're trying to come up with here, the question isn't who took the picture, but the question is the picture you?
Yes. At the time, it was consensual, but it was not consensual in terms of putting it into the universe.
All right. So then the consensual notion of a photograph changes over time, period, is what you're saying.
Yes.
How do you make an exception in the case of, say, you know, Anthony Weiner? Is there a public interest in those pictures being made public, or are people trying to destroy his reputation because maybe they want his seat in Congress?
There is a provision in the bill that would provide for an exception for what is considered legitimate public interest, whether it's Abu Ghraib or Anthony Weiner. If you can establish that there's a legitimate public interest, then their request to have it taken down would not be sustainable.
What's the test of that legitimate public interest? That's going to be a hard one.
Well, that's the nub, of course, because then that would be tested in the courts. If you would argue there's a legitimate public interest, then you could foreseeably keep them up. But then, you know, you would be potentially challenged in court, and then that would be determined through the courts.
Can the court system really address this? I mean, I remember the famous line after Ray Donovan, Labor Secretary, went through the whole legal system on corruption charges and was basically exonerated. And I think his first comment was something like, you know, where do I go to get my reputation back? I mean, the way this would work, you could still have your career and reputation ruined and still have the photographs taken down. And then what have you achieved, really?
Hopefully we don't get to that kind of a situation. That's why the legislation is necessary. We already have, under the Digital Millennial Copyright Act, a provision whereby websites do take down information or material that is inappropriate. So this is just building on what is existing law in many respects.
Does this really apply only to sexual content, or is that a hard distinction to make as to what destroys a reputation and what is just simply tasteless sexual content?
Well, the language we're using is it would be unlawful to reproduce or otherwise disseminate a visual depiction of an individual who is nude or engaging in sexually explicit behavior without their written consent. So it really focuses in on the term that has become, I guess, most commonplace to use, revenge porn.
In terms of your legal advice that you're getting on this, how challenging is this to the First Amendment and the doctrine of the Supreme Court in protecting speech? And, you know, in terms of pornography in general, it's really a pretty open domain.
Well, it is. And that's why it's been very difficult to craft this bill in a way that does protect the First Amendment. And I am, you know, a First Amendment fanatic. But I also recognize that there is an area here that must be addressed. So, you know, it'll be tested certainly in Congress, and we'll see how we can kind of thread this needle so we can protect the First Amendment.
What personal story motivated you to really take up this challenge? Because as you describe, it's going to be tough to word a bill that's going to make it and pass all these tests.
Well, there's not just one story. Unfortunately, there are hundreds and hundreds of these stories, and that's why 15 states have already taken action to pass laws against what is called revenge porn and create a means by which you can prosecute an individual who doesn't comply with those laws. We do need a national law, I believe, that reflects the interests of all Americans and also protects the First Amendment, rather than have, you know, 50 different states take up this issue. I think that what we need to do is recognize that it's not just one case, it's many cases. The cases that have gotten publicity are really very troubling. I mean, they destroy people's lives, and they have images that are everywhere. And they cannot control it when they had never given consent. You do have a right to privacy that is protected. And, you know, that's what we're trying to balance here.
Congresswoman, before we go, can I speak to the sociologist in you?
I don't know if there is one, but go ahead.
Let's find out. Is it possible that this whole issue, as important as it is and as important as the stories of the victims are that you tell, that this is a sign of a transitory period, that essentially what we're seeing is a kind of an end to concern about this sort of thing, that in the very near future, some creep starting up some weird revenge porn website is just going to be completely ignored because the consequences of this sexualization in the media, the internet itself, and just a kind of a free and open sort of youth culture in the Western world and in the United States is just going to make all of this, you know, what, NBD, no big deal?
I suppose there's a potential for that. We have lots of laws on the books that don't really relate to our world today. I mean, I do think we in government have a responsibility to act with the events of today and hope that it has relevance in the future. Lots of times it does, and sometimes it doesn't.
But based on the community standards that you see today, this is a worthy mission on your part.
Oh, I believe so. And there's just hundreds and hundreds of cases, maybe thousands of cases, where this is destroying people's lives. And unless you're, you know, a celebrity with a fat wallet and high-priced attorneys, it's very hard to get any kind of solution or peace of mind.
Well, Congresswoman Jackie Speier is attempting to come up with both of those in legislation being drafted. She's a Democrat from California. Congresswoman Speier, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
What you'd like to express yourself as a woman online? We're going to have conversations about that subject all week. You can join us on Wednesday for an online Twitter chat on the subject. For more details or to listen back to anything you heard on today's show, visit thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.